You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 249 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in separate locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And as we celebrate this anniversary in episode 249, the Super Bowl 249 had been canceled participants.
Yeah, was called off late in the late stages of it. Well, let's not spend too long reminiscing about that, even though apparently Marshawn Lynch, I think we saw that. I didn't actually pay any attention to that, but apparently he's over it now, so that's a good sign. That's something. Maybe Seahawks fans can stop obsessing over it on Twitter for the rest of time.
It didn't happen, so I'm over it.
There you go. That's one way to do it. All right, let's talk about this week's beer to get us started. We've got from, again, our friends at Stoop Brewing, the Tentorama IPA. Here's their description. White tents, red tents with plastic windows, big tents, little tents blowing up the street in a windstorm, which is a little too true over the past weekend in Seattle, unfortunately. If you wanted a beer or a meal or just a place to see your friends other than at Zoom happy hour, you've likely headed to a tent. We're not talking about the fun ones in the woods. These are purely functional. And while we'd rather be gathering together in our regular haunts, thank goodness for tents. Enjoy this beer at home or in a tent, but wherever you imbibe this Simcoe Citra and Strata hop delight, raise a glass to our canvas and pole heroes.
This beer is a little bit too on the nose with the description. I want beer to not acknowledge what's going on in the world.
I feel like we've had a lot of beer acknowledging what's going on in the world because we had Cloudburst for a while before we got into the stoop.
I want beer to not acknowledge some of the things that are going on in the world. I thought there was somebody who tweet that I read where it's like, I hope that Super Bowl commercials just act like nothing is wrong.
Well,
and I actually feel like for the most part they kind of did.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciated. It was just like, we don't need Super Bowl commercials to be a bummer.
Wait, they don't need to have a message. They're just selling products.
Yeah.
Like, come on. At the end of the day, that's all we're doing here. Mm-hmm. Just like Stoop is selling this delicious Tentorama IPA.
That is pretty good.
Wow. You say that minutes after, before the pod, you swore off IPAs forever.
I didn't swear off IPAs because of taste.
True. Well, we start out this week on a sad note because we got some really devastating news last Thursday when we learned that Chris Brannon, better known to everyone in the Seattle sports community as Sonics guy, died at age 47 of heart failure. And whether you knew him personally or not, you definitely, if you were a Seattle sports fan, attended pretty much any event in the past decade here, knew Sonics guy on site because of the fact that he was walking around at Seahawks games, at Husky tailgates, dressed in head-to-toe green and gold, carrying probably a sign advocating for the team's return, for advocating for expansion. Like, there has been no more visible symbol of the Sonics in the past decade than Sonics guy.
Absolutely. I mean, pretty devastating news to learn. You know, obviously, I didn't know him personally, or at least as well as you did. I'm not in photos with him that were being posted on the internet.
I mean, that was actually the only time we've ever met. Like I said, it was, you know, I knew who he was, but I had never spoken to him until that was at the celebration of Jack Sikma's Hall of Fame induction a couple of summers ago.
Well, and I think he was an important figure and beacon for the movement of getting the Sonics to return. Somebody who you could look to and who seemed pretty singularly focused on this goal publicly everywhere, right? It didn't feel like self-promotion. There was really nothing else to it. It was just, he wants the Sonics back. He is Sonics guy. And seemed like such a big personality. And to pass what seems like potentially so close to when the team may be announced as returning, you know, potentially within it at the very least years for that announcement is really devastating.
Definitely. You mentioned big personality. Part of his non-Sonics persona was that he was a booker for the Tacoma and Seattle underground comedy clubs and a fixture in the comedy scene in the area, as well as, you know, the sports scene. And sadly, I had not before today ever seen, there was a short film called Superfan done by Lee Burmish that debuted at the Seattle International Film Festival. It's, you know, pretty short, about 6 to 7 minutes, but just follows him around at a Seahawks tailgate and sees the reactions.
Oh, I've actually gives seen a little him backstory. At a number of Seahawks tailgates. I kind of forgot about that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking in that, in the background of that video, and I think he was on the other side of Fourth Avenue. I think he was on the Sixth Avenue side, but it definitely looked like where we've been known to tailgate before Seahawks games.
Oh, see, I'd forgotten about that on Third Avenue, right? And you're there and Sonics guy comes by and it's just like, it's a moment, right? You have that time period before the game, everybody's hanging out. It's a lot of monotony, you know, if you're doing that for 3 hours and then Sonics guy comes by and you're like, here we go. Let's get a beer to Sonics guy. Let's hang out for a second, traveling from tailgate to tailgate.
Yeah. Like, I noticed he had some food in hand and had a burger in hand as he was doing the filming. And it was like, yeah, that's definitely, you're going to offer him some food if he comes by. I think you mentioned, you know, the visible symbol. There was this period of time where the Sonics were in some danger of being forgotten, especially by, you know, like generations that come up that no longer remember a period of time when the Sonics were playing basketball. And I think he was a big part of making sure that that didn't happen, that they stayed visible. And one of the fascinating things in that short film, which everyone should check out, there will be a link in the post. He kept a list of all the events he went to. And really? The crowds at that, in terms of like how many people he was getting the message out to, that was kind of remarkable. But the last line, very poignantly, we will eventually get a team back, but who knows how long eventually is. And yeah, I mean, it's just, nobody would have appreciated it more. It's tremendous sadness that, you know, he's not going to be around to see when that day comes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think a human representation that this isn't about corporate money and stuff like that, right? You know, this is about a person who's working to bring a basketball team back to a city. This is about humans and individuals. And you talked about spreading that word, you know? And I think generations of kids coming up in Seattle, people like Sonics guy, not having a team, not seeing a team for that long time period. And it makes you think just kind of back to how callous a team moving is, that you develop these relationships and it's gone from people's lives, you know, something that should be a fixture of your life every fall, winter, into the spring, summer, paying attention to basketball in the city of Seattle, that we have not had for decades now. And that the, you know, that quote about, you don't know how long eventually is for Sonics guy, it's forever now, you know, and missing out on the team ever coming back in his lifetime is pretty devastating.
Well, I think the other thing is it's easy to take for granted having a sports team before they move. And, you know, in our case, the fact that we were season ticket holders from a young age and able to go to all these games. And I do think, you know, obviously you don't want it to happen this way, but there is a greater appreciation when you do lose a team. So.
Well, and before we move on, also want to mention, thinking of the people throughout Texas, especially unhoused individuals throughout Texas going through this cold front, and people who are without power there and not able to keep themselves warm, not able to find shelter during this time period. There are a lot more important things going on in the world and in the country than talking about a search for Seattle's best fried chicken. And there are a lot of people right now who are suffering and are cold. And there are other people out there who are trying to use this moment for political gain, and really just thinking about those people who are suffering in the moment, who might not have power, who might not have a place to go to when it is, you know, sub-zero temperatures in a place like Texas.
I mean, not just Texas. I mean, Texas, it's more unexpected. So therefore it's more of an issue, but obviously this cold front is hitting the entire Midwest and much of the country right now. So we were fortunate to just kind of get the fun version of it with a couple of days of snow. Well, I don't know that there's an easy way now after that to transition to, in fact, talking about our search for Seattle's best fried chicken. But we did manage to get a stop in before we were snowed in for the weekend and hit up Fats Chicken and Waffles in the Central District. So a little backstory that I did not learn until I started doing the research for this chicken search ties two of our locations we're going to be doing potentially back to back together. So Fifth Talk and Taco Time co-host Marcus Lilario was set to open Fats Wings and Waffles. That's by the way, if you haven't listened to...
I like that you just naturally included that.
This week's Talk and Taco Time. You may not understand that reference. You got to check that out. That's what they're known as now. He was set to open what they were going to call Fats Wings and Waffles in Rainier Beach with Chef Darren McGill. But before that opened, the two of them split amicably. McGill ended up partnering with Nate Robinson on Nate's Wings and Waffles, whose menu mostly lives on at Dre's Lake Rod Eatery, which I think we hope to get to this week for next week's podcast. And then instead, Lario purchased the location of the legendary former Catfish Corner at MLK and Cherry to open Fats Chicken and Waffles, which is coincidentally named after a member of the Jackson family and friend of Marcus's. The Jackson family operated Catfish Corner, who they were also related to Steven Jackson, famously provided food to the Steven Jackson's teams anytime that they would come through town to play against the Sonics. Definitely remembered that one. And Catfish Corner now operating under different ownership is Catfish Corner Express in Skyway. But Marcus ended up partnering with Chef Erica White, who went to nearby Garfield and has Louisiana roots that inspire the menu at Fats to open that location in 2015. And so going on 6 years now for Fats Chicken and Waffles. You've been there before, right?
Never. This is my first ever time having Fats Chicken and
Waffles. I've only been once, which is not enough.
It's pretty wild that I haven't been there before.
I mean,
given all of this.
It's right up our alley.
Yeah.
So this time is befits the name. We both went with the chicken and waffle option. That wasn't it, but we'll get to the rest of it. Where you get an option of breast, thigh, or chicken legs with it. And we both took the breast. And I didn't realize, I advertised that we were going to be eating bones last week. And it turns out that the chicken breast that comes with the chicken and waffle is in fact boneless. Although we also got a side order of legs to split.
I was going to say, we ate bones. Come on, people.
Okay, so what did you think?
I don't think that I got the chicken and waffle in the situation that would best serve the quality of the chicken and waffle.
That's abundantly clear, yes.
That's the worst thing about it. I mean, that's the worst thing about this whole... Not the worst thing about this whole pandemic. That's the worst thing about this whole pandemic as it relates to takeout food. You know, and Eric Rivera talked about this, which is like, you know, chefs are making food to be eaten pretty much immediately, right? You're not making food to travel to from the Central District to your house in Boulevard Park to Jan's car to Fairwood, Washington 5 hours later, right? Like, that is not how food is meant to travel. Even in this era of like DoorDashing and things like that, like, we're bastardizing, to be clear, things like DoorDash are bastardizing the food that we're eating. We're actively making it worse. We're choosing convenience over quality.
We're choosing safety over quality.
Yes, that too. But I'm saying if we're talking outside of the conversation of safety, right? If we're doing DoorDash when you're safe to go into restaurants, then we're choosing convenience over quality. But I think that probably hurt this particular chicken. The other thing is that I don't know if the chicken that came with the waffle really would be a competitor for Seattle's Best Chicken, because it is so specifically made to be eaten with the waffle, which, it's a very thin patty of chicken, right? It's meant to sort of be eaten with the waffle in one serving. Whereas Screen Door in Portland, right, they're giving you fat pieces of chicken. It's basically
they're
like
pounded thin. They're just very, very large pieces
of
chicken.
Man, I do not remember them being pounded that thin. Like, these are the Fast Chicken and Waffle Chicken was super thin. Like, it was like a quarter inch, you know. It's a very thin slice of chicken breast, which just isn't the best way to eat that food, right? You're getting a lot of the fried, but there's not as much of the juicy chicken in the middle, which is
You don't agree to disagree with you on this take.
But I'm saying that I want more. It's not like nobody's doing anything wrong here, right? It's perfect to be eaten with the waffle, but we're viewing this more from the prism of specifically the chicken. And to me, the thing that stood out, I actually ate it the next day, maybe even 2 days later.
It was 2 days, yes.
Was the chicken leg that we got, which was probably the best fried chicken that we've had so far.
Okay, here we go. Now we're coming around to this. I liked the chicken breast much more than you did, quite clearly.
There was nothing against it. I'm just saying I don't think that a very thin slice of chicken breast meant to be eaten on top of a waffle can be Seattle's best chicken. But the chicken leg was perfectly fried 2 days later after traveling all those different places, being handled by Jan even for a moment. And...
she was it like individually
somehow reduces
handling.
The quality of food.
She was just
look,
just
if you tried her food, you would understand what I'm saying.
Oh no.
We didn't we didn't like burgers on the grill growing up. This is Jan's fault. The best food that she made was the Jennie-O chicken in the little tub, right?
Turkey. I don't know if it's better or worse.
The Jennie-O turkey in the little silver tub. We're like, at least Jan can't fuck this up.
Mom has some strong suits in her cooking. I do think you're selling her short hair.
But the chicken, after all that time period, plus 2 days of sitting in my fridge, that chicken leg was a freaking winner.
That's what I had first, I think, because I was just hungry and dug into that immediately. Because we'll talk about this later. My trip to Fats was delayed by the storm series of trades on Wednesday, which I had to wait to write about those before I went and got lunch. So I was very hungry by the time I tore into this. So I went through the leg first and then ate the chicken and waffle. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the things you didn't mention is there's a nice amount of spice in this chicken. It's not like some of the bland fried chicken that we've had at times during this search.
It's really tough to compare when, well, look, I understand people's complaints about this. Like when you're comparing a chicken strip to a chicken leg, like they're pretty different things that we're dealing with here. So it's a little tough. I don't know if I can confidently say like the chicken leg was better than Bok Bok because they're such totally different beasts, but definitely of any of the bone-in fried chicken that we've had so far, this was my favorite.
Yeah. What did you think of, how many of the sides did you try? So it was essentially some mac and cheese.
I had some mac and cheese.
The collard greens.
I did not have any of the collard greens.
Yeah, I only had a little bit of that, and then which were solid. And then a cornbread muffin.
I think the cornbread muffin was pretty great.
It was maybe the highlight.
I was just eating it so frantically in between like working or whatever, where I'm heating it up and trying to focus in on the waffle, you know, the chicken and the waffle. So not trying to put too much emphasis on the sides, which I thought was good. It was so far from being presented in the right way that I think it was really difficult to judge.
Which is too bad because this stuff actually does photograph really well, I think, if you get it there or at least in the original serving form, not hours later. There was kind of like a honey glaze on the cornbread muffin. That was great.
The cornbread muffin, it was like falling apart with the honey glaze. I was like, damn, this is pretty good.
Be sure to check that out if you hit up Fats, which by the way, you have a chance to this Thursday. Should mention this, the aforementioned Storm, along with the Sounders, have partnered with the Internationalist to sponsor tabs at different Black-owned restaurants in the Seattle area during Black History Month. And in the Storm's case, specifically Black woman-owned restaurants. So on Thursday, they'll be hosting a $250 tab at Fats that you can take advantage of. So check out that on stay tuned for that on their social media for details on how to take advantage of that.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Okay, do we have a rating for the Fats fried chicken?
Wow, it's really tough. It because of the situation that we had it in. This is one that I want to revisit every chicken. I'm gonna go ahead and judge it pretty heavily based upon that chicken leg and the situation that I had it. And I'm gonna give it an 88.
That is precisely what I gave it as well. So that is my highest score thus far.
I think there's a conversation here. And I think so far, the ones that have really stood out to me as far as, you know, like legit contenders are Fats and Baka Baka, I think, in particular, ones that we're going to be returning to.
I'd have Jax in that conversation as well. I think that all three of them are in a pretty similar range, I would say. So next week, again, the plan is to finally hit Dre's Lake Rat Eatery, which we have been putting off for a couple weeks here.
I gotta eat it faster. Sooner. Maybe I'll pick that up.
It is conveniently located between your house and my house, which is different from many of these locations we're going to. While we're on the topic of food, we should discuss the third week of Lil Woody's Seattle Burger Month, which continues with the Dessoud or Southern Burger from Daisley Gordon of Cafe Campania. This was an interesting one, a patty that's mixed grass-fed beef and ground lamb, whipped goat cheese with touches of rosemary, harissa red pepper mayo, pickled onions, and capers. What did you think of this one?
It's so frustrating. Caring about food in this time period where both I'm having to balance eating things with, you know, working and stuff like that, and the travel that it takes, right? Because you got this in White Center.
Correct.
And I've explained to you look, we've been through how White Center and Fairwood, Washington are the two farthest points on earth from each other. I reheated it, but there's never getting it to the same place. You know, it's when it's fresh. I thought the patty was really good. You could taste the lamb. It's something where I think, you know, there's sometimes in the Lil Woody's burgers where it's almost like too much beef, or it's a little bit too much beef forward. So being able to taste lamb was really nice. And I thought that the red pepper mayo was really good, plus the pickled onions. But it was just like the whole package. It's hard to hold together when I'm eating it, again, probably hours after you picked it up.
It's going to be a real challenge for me to pick my favorite for this year's Seattle Burger Month when we do it at the end of this, because I really enjoyed last week's Cochi Loco, and this week was right up there because as you mentioned, like
they have an idea for Lil Woody's.
What's that?
What they should do is Burger Month, 4 weeks in February, totally get it, right? The first week of March, they should have, this is probably too ambitious, they should have all four burgers available in the first week of March. Tons of ingredients so that you could go back and double up on whatever burger is your favorite.
Well, that's way too ambitious. What I thought you were going to say is they should just have a poll and pick the favorite.
Vote on
and
the winner.
Make that.
I don't want anybody to be the loser, though. Look, I understand what it feels like to lose a Twitter poll.
No.
Right? If let's just
say, I mean, I do too. And somehow I'm not nearly as broken up. I mean, I guess I didn't finish third.
I think I finished fourth. I think I finished below dead silence. Awkward silence.
Awkward silence, you the real MVP. Anyways,
I finished below part that Kevin should have edited out and didn't.
Oh no. time we thought that something went wrong, but it was actually just an extended awkward pause. I was trying to talk about the harissa red pepper mayo because, which by the way, I somehow typed in here as red paper mayo. That doesn't seem like it would be as good. That was the star of the show here.
Yes.
It reminded me, I would say in many ways, of the chipotle mayo that is featured on the Raging Cajun sandwich at Lil Woody's, or Lil Woody's, at the Other Coast, which is when
I was like, tell me more about this Lil Woody's Raging Cajun, because I want that.
I mean, two great tastes, the trade sandwich made together, perhaps.
God, I want a Raging Cajun right now. I haven't had a Raging Cajun in literally a year. Fuck!
I don't think I have either. I definitely have not prioritized that sufficiently during the pandemic. I think
they moved that Other Coast that was in Queen Anne, right?
It closed permanently. Yeah. I think only the Ballard location is still operating at this
really?
Point.
Really? Huh.
I'm going strong, but that's the only one, I think. So that, as we know, Seattle's number two sandwich, the Raging Cajun. So I know you're partial to the Tad Strawberry.
We don't need to revisit this.
Yes, you can go back and review the tapes from the live podcast.
Strawberry is so good.
It's very good.
I haven't had that in a year either.
Me neither. Ah! There's a lot of good food out there, suffice it to say. Check it all out. But definitely.
check it out, food.
But all of that. But the rest of it, you can get anytime. The Dessoud burger, you can only get this week. That's the key.
I finished fifth somehow in a four-person poll. finished below. Check your phone to see if the podcast stopped, or is it just an extended awkward silence?
There's an Arrested Development joke about where repeatedly someone else gets more votes in the class president than, but I can't remember what it is or who it is now, and I got to try and look it up. So I don't know when to go to do that.
I love that. I finished below you telling a joke that you don't remember. You referencing the idea of there being a joke, but not remembering the joke. Then there's Tristan. That finished a solid number two after the famous cousin Katie. Bullshit, Paul.
All right. I haven't double checked. We forgot to check on this before the podcast. This is some of that classic Pelton cast preparation that we've come to be known for.
I finished below that too.
Are we having your favorite segment this week?
Kevin researches something. Oh, by the way, I had the idea for a really great episode. I meant to tell you this offline. Fuck it. You ready for it? Okay. The week that South by Southwest would be, I think we do a South by Southwest themed episode where we drink Shinerbachs because we can't get Lone Star in Washington State. I checked. We drink Shinerbachs. Maybe we eat a barbecue that week, or like we eat a barbecue place, maybe chicken from a barbecue place that week.
Okay.
And I can do like a ranking of like top 10 under the radar bands to check out.
All right. There you go.
You like that? That's a pretty good idea, isn't it?
Are we going to do a Sloan week? I don't know what that would entail in terms of.
Hell yes, we are. Are we going to do
just a lot of statistical analysis, I guess.
You're going to go through awkward conversations in a hotel room with Nate Duncan. You're going to go through, oh God, what is the dude who makes the charts names?
Kurt Goldsberry?
Yeah, Kurt Goldsberry. Just recalling conversations that you and Kurt Goldsberry had. Top 10 under the radar stats. long explanation of your jokes about Abdul Nader.
And just not enough people get that reference. I don't get it.
Oh, I read this tweet to you and it ended up, I was like, can you explain this to me? And it ended up with you talking about how the what is the book called by Ralph Nader?
Unsafe at Any Speed.
Unsafe at Any Speed is a seminal work. This was a quote, a seminal work, Unsafe at Any Speed by Ralph Nader.
It sort of launched the entire thing of consumer protection. It's been very important.
Don't burn yourself.
So we do have this segment?
Sort of.
Okay. Well, even though there's snow on the ground still, a little bit, not all of it is melted yet. Later this week, pitchers and catchers will report to spring training, which means it's time for the return of your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
Get out the Boston pizza and the bare naked ladies, Nana, because the Big Maple is back. That's right. James Paxton has returned. And in Seattle, we are dressing up in our Canadian tuxedos to celebrate this signing. And that's all I have. All I know is that he's Canadian.
Wow, you really
Nickelback, Avril Lavigne, Pup, we've got them all.
You really ran out of steam fast there. It was a lot of steam at the start. And then
I told Mrs. Fantasy Genius, I was like, Kevin told me to do a Mariners hot takes about James Paxton returning. And literally all I know about the situation is that he's Canadian. So anyway, check out our clubhouse chat later this week on Is James Paxton Canadian? At PeltonCast on Clubhouse.
You know, you could have gone for a like going to the Yankees and returning theme. I like Jeff Nelson came back after he went to the Yankees, right? Mm-hmm. That was a thing.
Bare naked ladies wouldn't have come up, so.
No, under no circumstances would they have. The Mariners have re-signed James Paxton to a reported 1-year, $8.5 million deal with additional incentives that could take the value to $10 million. The M's traded him to the Yankees for a package headlined by Justice Sheffield after the 2018 season. Paxton pitched reasonably well in 2019, including into the playoffs, before undergoing an offseason discectomy to remove a cyst. After five poor starts last season, he was shut down in mid-August after suffering a forearm flexor strain, apparently had an impressive bullpen session in November that helped spur his market and decided to come back and rejoin the Mariners. Also, I learned from the news story about this on ESPN that apparently the Mariners are planning to go with a six-man rotation again this season.
What?
Yeah. So they would currently project is Paxton, Marco Gonzalez, Yusei Kikuchi, Sheffield, Justin Dunn, and newcomer Chris Flexen.
Oh, hell yeah. You know, you're just preparing the puns for that one. Come on, Mariners. You can't have a player named Chris Flexen and have Kevin Pelton live in the city of Seattle at the same time.
Like, you know that my puns tend to be thinkers. So I don't
That's too easy. Chris Flexen is too easy for you.
You did we'll come up with something.
Same conversation about his name is Abdul Nader.
Yes.
You did mention that you felt like any Bradley Pinion jokes were too low hanging fruit for you.
During the I mean, it's just, I've been there. I've done that now.
Yeah. You've moved on. You're bearing the lead here though, which is the Mariners have the number two farm system per Baseball America.
That is true. Yeah.
This is a different Mariners team than we've seen. Look, they have one more starter than you're used to.
It is definitely not your, I don't know, at this point, it's not your Mariners team, I guess. I don't know, because we're old.
So using a six-man rotation, I hate to get serious here when talking at the Mariners, it's actually a really bad way to allocate your resources if you're paying James Paxton one year, $8.5 million, which I assume for the Mariners is a fairly solid chunk of money, right?
Yes.
If you're only pitching him one every 6 days, that's not a good way to allocate the resources.
And we'll see where they stuck with it. I mean, teams generally did it last season because of the fact that there were so many double headers with the unusual schedule. Who knows what the schedule is going to look like this season? I mean,
aren't they're trying to play a regular schedule, right?
That's the plan. It's also February 16th. There was a plan in February 16th last year, and then things did not go according to plan, as it turned out. So
that's not really.
I mean,
God, if I get to go to Diamond Club one time this year, I will just be so happy. I know it's not going to happen. I have my calendar marked for like fucking June 2022, but like, oh God, I miss it.
You know what? I was thinking earlier today about Capitol Hill Block Party. And the last time I went there in 2019, and just like the sea of humanity that was there. And I was like, man, like even in a world where we're all vaccinated, I don't know if that's going to work this summer.
I mean, I'm not going to.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I know some things.
I'm sure you know.
I think everybody knows some things. Like, we're in the middle of a pandemic.
We sure are.
Nothing is going to work this summer.
Oh boy. Well, let's hope some things work this summer, but yeah, not necessarily jamming people in as close together as possible. All right, not much news this week on the Sounders front, but we did get a report from Stephen Goff of the Washington Post that the MLS will delay the start of training camps until March 1st after the pushback, I guess, of the timetable to complete the collective bargaining agreement between the league and its players. And the regular season, MLS has announced, is now set to start on April 17th. So it's going to be a short MLS regular season compared to what we're used to. Last year, of course, they began on the first weekend of March.
14 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, it was a busy week for the Seattle Storm. We talked on the podcast last Tuesday about them signing Candace Dupree after the retirement of veteran front court player Crystal Langhorne, but that was just an appetizer of what was to come on Wednesday, is I don't know if I want to say earth-shattering, but definitely a momentous series of trades involving the Storm. There was five trades on Wednesday involving five teams, nearly half the league, I believe six players and four draft picks. And the Storm were at the center of all of this. They sent out Natasha Howard after using the core designation on her as a free agent, and Sammy Whitcomb. They both went to the New York Liberty. via sign and trade. In return, the Storm brought back young forwards Makia Herbert-Harrigan and Katie Lou Samuelson, the rights to forward Stephanie Talbot, who they signed to a training camp contract on Thursday, as well as veteran Tamara Young, and then a pair of 2022 second-round picks. So you add this on top of the Alicia Clark signing in Washington a couple weeks ago, and two starters from the Storm's championship teams, as well as a third key rotation player in Sammy Whitcomb, now gone during this year's free agency.
Yeah, a big shakeup for the Storm. I guess, can you start by walking us through why the Storm were making all these moves? You know, they seem like a team that they've been a pretty steady team for the last handful of years, and these are major shakeups that are happening. So why now?
So I think it's a combination of a few things. Number one, it's pretty evident from all the moves they've made and the contracts they've signed that they're very concerned about being able to keep their young core together in 2022 free agency, because you've got next year, Jewel Lloyd and Brianna Stewart will both be unrestricted free agents, assuming Stewie doesn't sign an extension between now and then, because she can sign a Supermax extension. Jewel Lloyd can't sign a Supermax extension. It would be too big of a raise on her current salary, so she has to go to free agency to maximize her next salary. So you got the two of them are probably going to be at the Supermax next year. You've got potentially Sue Bird at a large amount, whatever it is, if she decides to play again in 2022. And then Jordan Canada and Mercedes Russell is kind of younger core players, are both going to be restricted free agents at the conclusion of their rookie contracts. So big raises for them as well. So I think that was a key factor in the Storm deciding to move on from some of these veteran players and make sure that they didn't box themselves in terms of salary next year. You could have played it out, and like there's a world where if they had just let Sammy Whitcomb go, that they could have re-signed Natasha Howard and Alicia Clark at their current salaries if those players had been interested in it, and just brought this whole team back next year, basically the whole starting five back next year, and then tried to deal with it in the summer, in the 2022 offseason. I'm used to saying summer from the NBA, but it's winter in the WNBA. But that wasn't necessarily, I don't think, their plan. And then also, I think there was an element of, you know, I think it's quite possible that Natasha Howard wanted a larger role similar to the one she played in 2019 when she was an all-WNBA first team pick, and very different from last year where, you know, in the playoffs, a lot of the time Mercedes Russell ended up a more important contributor than Natasha Howard, as good as Natasha Howard is. So, you know, I think that was a factor. And then the third thing would be, you know, Sammy Whitcomb ended up signing an awesome contract for her, about $150,000 a year over the next 2 years as part of that sign and trade. But I think it's a reasonable possibility that the Liberty might have been prepared to offer her even more on an offer sheet if they were trying to make sure the Storm didn't match that contract.
Interesting. So what should we expect from these players that the Storm are bringing back next season?
Yeah, so I think the really interesting aspect of this trade is the Storm could have just made the trades with the trades with the Liberty and not involved the other two teams, Minnesota and Dallas, that were involved here. And then they would have gotten the number one pick in this year's draft from New York, as well as Phoenix's number one pick in 2022. And they ended up swapping both of those draft picks for current players. So the number one pick went to Dallas for Katie Lou Samuelson, who was a star at UConn, looked like someone who was going to be a quality WNBA player, was the number four pick in the draft. She played with Stewie and Morgan Tuck, who's still on the roster as a freshman, big time shooter at UConn, and hasn't been able to translate that yet in the WNBA. Didn't play a lot as a rookie with Chicago. She got traded last offseason to Dallas in a deal that netted Chicago Azure Stevens, who's really a quality young player. So it wasn't like they were giving up on Samuelson, but then, you know, she played more minutes in Dallas, but wasn't super effective. And then just kind of didn't figure into their future because they've got a number of young forwards. So they were thrilled, I'm sure, to get the number one pick for her. Sort of the bet the Storm are making, I think, is that this year's draft, they had a need on the wing and at the forward spots. And this year's draft isn't considered super deep in those spots. The projected number one pick is a center out of Texas. So you know, that's a position I think they already feel like they have covered. The other thing I should have mentioned earlier is trading Natasha Howard. It's also a bet that Ezzie Magbogor is the Storm center of the future after as well as she played as a rookie, and that she can do a lot of the same things for you that Natasha Howard did. So I think that's an element of this too. But, you know, they're betting that Katie Lou Samuelson is going to be better than anyone in this year's draft, especially this season. Now, the downside is you've only got 2 years left on her rookie contract, whereas you would have 4 years on the rookie contract for the number one pick. Something kind of similar with Herbert Harrigan. She was the number six pick in last year's draft. That's probably more or less where you would ballpark the Phoenix pick coming in 2022. Didn't play a ton as a rookie in Minnesota. Did shoot the three really well. And that's something you're hoping that she can translate here and maybe be a more athletic, more versatile defender than Katie Lou Samuelson can be. And then I do think Talbot, you know, has a chance to make the roster and contribute. She was someone who started against the Storm a little bit during the 2018 Western Conference Finals when she was in Phoenix, played an important role in Minnesota in 2019, her last season in the WNBA. She didn't come over last year during the pandemic. The one question mark there is, you know, she's been a fixture on the Australian national team, so she would probably want to go play for them during the Olympics, as Ezzie Magbogor might as well. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see how the Storm handles that, assuming the Olympics do happen.
Well, and then what should be, given all that, our expectation for the Storm heading into this 2021 season? Are they still WNBA favorites?
No. I think at this point, pretty clearly the Aces are the favorites. They've had a really strong offseason. They lost one of their starters, Kaylee McBride, but replaced her with Chelsea Gray, who's maybe even a little better and more versatile, better, you know, a similar shooter. They added Raquana Williams, who was one of the WNBA's best reserves last season. You know, they already had the top six woman player in terms of the voting in De'Erica Hamby. So they also presumably we'll get Elizabeth Cambage back. Cambage was their core player this year after she sat out the 2020 season. So you add all that up and Vegas looks like the clear favorite to me. I think Washington is in that top tier. And then Minnesota, which added Ariel Powers, Caleb McBride, who came from Las Vegas, and then also Natalie Achonwa in free agency to the team that got the semifinals last year where they lost to the Storm. So I think those three teams right now are at the top and the Storm is going to try to emerge out of that kind of second tier. Like, obviously, you still have Breanna Stewart and Jewel Lloyd and, you know, hopefully a healthy Sue Bird, Ezzie for most of the season, hopefully. You know, that's a strong core to work with, but you've taken a pretty enormous step back defensively to lose Natasha Howard, who was the defensive player of the year in 2019, Alicia Clark, who was the only unanimous selection of the All-WNBA defensive first team last year. Those are two core players defensively, and Clark in particular is going to be really difficult to defend, to replace as a defender. That's the weakness of Katie Lou Samuelson's game. You know, Herbert Harrigan may be a better chance to provide that, but it's going to be a lot to ask of a young player, given what an important role player Alicia Clark became at both ends of the court.
Well, and then what about the Storm long-term? Has this improved their long-term prospects rather than maybe they took a step back for one season, but they'll be more protected longer-term?
I do think so, because, I mean, you know, Alicia Clark was getting older and they didn't necessarily have a replacement for her beforehand. And now they've got two young forwards with a lot of potential in Samuelson and Harrigan and Herbert Harrigan, and then just kind of balance their books better because, you know, Samuelson will be on her cheaper rookie deal for 2 years, Herbert Harrigan for 3 years. And that's going to help them a great deal. I think they got deeper for this season and potentially deeper for years to come as well.
Okay. And I guess this is my final question on it. Because I think, as a lot of people, I woke up the day after we podcast and just like, what the fuck is happening? Let's say you're doing trade grades on it or whatever, right? How do you feel in general about these moves?
I would feel a lot better about them if the Storm had just kept the number one pick.
Really?
Yeah, I just don't think that Katie Lou Samuelson, what we've seen her from her the first couple of seasons, has merited the number one pick. And like I said, going from 4 years of a rookie contract to two, that's a dicey proposition, even if you're convinced that the player is better than you're going to get at the number one pick. And this is considered a weak draft. So that factored into it, undoubtedly, into their decision. But I would have kept that pick. And in that case, I think I could have talked myself into this, is you're sacrificing something in 2021, which is kind of a bummer when your point guard is 40 years old. But Jewel Loyd is, you know, 27, Brandon Stewart's 26, 27. They're both in that same age range. And that's sort of now where the Storm's focus is on players in their early to mid 20s. And so you are going to have an extended window. So I would say if it had been for the number one pick, it would have been probably in the B range. Because of the fact that they made that extra trade, I would put it down to like a C minus range, maybe, wow, maybe even lower than that.
Okay.
I mean, my first thought when I heard that they were trading the number one pick to Dallas for Katie Lou Samuelson is that, so Dallas also has the number two pick, the number five pick, the number seven pick, and the number 13 pick in this year's draft.
It's like me and 2K in like 2038 or whatever.
It's like everyone's jokes about the Thunder with Sam Presti have come to life in the Wings, who also had two of the top five picks last year, as well as the rookie of the year, but from the year, or not the rookie of the year, because Ogunbowale finished second to Nafisa Collier, but you know, another top pick in Eriko Ogunbowale from the year before. So they've got all of the young talent on their roster right now. But
wow.
But my first thought was, oh, they're flipping one for two, and then they'll get Katie Lou Samuelson to make up the difference. But then they didn't get any. They just got a 2021 second round pick.
They got none of those picks.
None of those picks.
Wow. Okay.
So,
well, I guess we'll see how this plays out. You know, what is the timetable right now for the Storm season?
I mean, training camp would typically begin in the middle of April. So, okay, you know, optimistic that they should be able to get that underway on time.
All right.
And probably won't hear a lot. Sue still has yet to officially re-sign. She was kind of waiting for them to get this all figured out to see how much money she would be able to, you know, if she need, how much of a discount she needed to take off the Supermax to fit everything in. But that'll be the one last real big piece to the roster before the draft in April.
All right. Well, a very different looking Storm that we'll see next year. I mean, they were a deep team. I'm pretty skeptical that a team with Breonna Stewart is not going to be a potential favorite in the WNBA, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I may be underselling just how good, you know, the pessimistic viewpoint is they had Stewie before they got Natasha Howard and were, you know, a one and done team in the playoffs and were not very good defensively. Oh, she's obviously, I mean, she was really good back then too. I think it's more Jewel Loyd's development that has changed their floor, because she was a big factor in why they struggled in that 2017 season. But the Jewel Loyd we saw in 2019 was a huge step forward. And, you know, she's in her prime as well. All right, let's talk about UW sports, starting with Husky softball is back. And it started in a big way with Gabby Plain throwing her second career perfect game.
Oh my God.
In the season opening win, she was named Pac-12 Pitcher of the Week. After not allowing a run to score in any of her four appearances at the UNLV tournament, as UW went 4-0 last weekend, they did get a test from Dixie State and a 6-5
wow
win. Yeah, you don't mess with Dixie State. Bailey Klingler.
We need Luca down here to tell us the nickname of Dixie State.
Thunderbirds, but I'm going to have to look that up. Bailey Klingler hit a pair of home runs, the second one tying the game with two outs in the seventh, before Silent Rain Espinosa got a walk-off walk with the bases loaded later in the same inning to win the game.
This is such a deep team. They didn't play softball last year.
They did. They played non-conference. And
then the season got canceled. So everybody's coming back.
Yes, everyone is back.
Wow. I mean, you see Silent Rain Espinosa, Gabby Plain, everybody's coming back for a full softball season. This is a team to be feared.
It's a very exciting thing. Dixie State Trailblazers, for the record. They were not the fun of them.
Speaking of which, you're not willing to acknowledge this 5-game win streak because you're scared.
There's been a lot of dame time, let me tell you. A lot of dame time. Huskies dropped one spot to third in the ESPN.com/USA softball top 25 behind Oklahoma, which outscored its opposition 72 last weekend.
Well, they didn't play Dixie State, though.
They didn't. Well, guess who's playing Dixie State again this weekend? It's the Huskies, because they're playing in the Dixie State Classic. Dixie's one of my favorite states. This weekend, they play at BYU on Thursday in a one-off
game.
I'll tell
you, Dixie is not one of my favorite states.
We're facing Dixie State, Nevada, Utah State, and Utah Valley in that Dixie State Classic, which, by the way, Dixie State, in case you were curious, located in St. George, Utah. St. George.
I stand by what I said.
UW women's basketball. A 50-35 win Friday at Arizona
State.
Just don't
mess with Nebraska. We're good.
Yeah, to snap their 8-game conference losing streak as they held the Sun Devils to 21% shooting, including 1 of 17 in the first quarter and 3 of 24 from three-point range. The 35 points by Arizona State were the fewest by a conference opponent against the Huskies since 1978, which predates Pac-10 women's basketball. On Sunday, a tougher outcome for the Huskies as they lost 75-53 at top 10 foe Arizona. This weekend, the Huskies scheduled for senior day, pending any possible rescheduled games. On Friday, they will take on Utah. Sunday, it's Colorado. With the extra year of eligibility, it's unclear which players might return now, but Alexis Grigsby and Kayla Rooks are the seniors in the rotation, along with Missy Peterson, who's missed this season due to an ACL tear. At 4-13, Utah on Friday should give the Huskies a chance to come up with a third conference win this season. And speaking of third conference wins,
hello,
UW men's basketball got one. It was a competitive long weekend for the Huskies. They were in it most of the way against the USC in a 69-54 loss on Thursday, then had a chance to tie.
Most of the way in a 15-point loss.
Well, I think USC kind of pulled away late.
It was a close 15.
I mean, USC is the best team in the Pac-12, as it turns out.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. Wow. They also have the best freshman in the country.
Really?
Yeah.
What's this person's name?
Evan Mobley. He's a likely top 3 pick in this year's NBA draft.
No, I know the name Evan Mobley. Okay. I did not know that he went to USC, but I do know that name.
There you go. Then they had a chance to tie it in the closing seconds on Saturday against UCLA, which successfully executed a fouling up three to hold on for a 64-61 win. And then Monday, the Huskies beat the Wazoo Cougars 65-63 for Mike Hopkins' first win over Kyle Smith at Washington State. The win ensures the Huskies will not finish with the worst conference win percentage in school history. So there you go. Both teams.
I'm mad about this, though, because I know who the coach was the worst win percentage in school history.
They still may have the worst SRS. Both teams played Monday without their leading scorers. Quade Green sat out for UW with a non-COVID illness, while Isaac Bonton was unavailable for Wazoo due to an injury suffered on Saturday against USC. Marcus Sahonis in Quade Green's stead stepped up with 29 points on 13 of 20 shooting, including the game winner after the Cougars tied the game with 10 seconds remaining.
Did he talk about how this was his house?
I don't think he did.
That would have been good shit.
I mean, the thing is, it's less meaningful, I think, for them to win in Pullman than it is for Noah Williams to win in Seattle. I would say that.
It's less meaningful for any person to win in Pullman.
We need to talk about Marcus Sahonis for a second, because he's like in the midst of this terrible season becoming a thing.
Really?
He's now using 29% of the Huskies plays, second to Quade Green, with a .599 true shooting percentage, which is second among regulars for the Huskies behind Riley Soren. He leads the Huskies in BPM. It's the best BPM, according to basketball or sportsreference.com, by a true sophomore at UW since Terrence Ross in 2011-12. Which he was selected in the lottery after that season. I don't think that Sahonis is going to be, but he's on the Andrew Andrews career path. Speaking of guards from Portland, and he's like a year ahead of Andrew Andrews. Andrew Andrews didn't get this good until his junior season.
I was thinking of, there's definitely a history of Husky guards developing. I mean, this is probably true throughout college basketball, but Husky guards developing throughout time, where you're a little bit like, yeah, this is okay. There's some moments. I mean, Justin Dentman being one that I think comes to mind. But as a freshman, it felt like Sahonis. He definitely had some moments last year, but you kind of felt like the whole thing was fool's gold.
Well, he was just overexposed. Like, they forced him to be the lead ball handler and playmaker as a freshman, and that was too much to ask. And I think the other thing we started to learn this year, I mean, obviously he played more point guard on Monday with Quade Green out. He's really a shooting guard. He's a scoring guard. Like, it's similar to Dentman, who his breakout senior year came after Isaiah Thomas arrived and pushed him to shooting guard.
Yeah, well, Isaiah Thomas is actually recommitted to UW, so
that's great. Oh,
that's exciting that there is having a positive to take away from this.
Exactly.
You know, I think is huge. Having a player who you could look at and say, this is going to be, he's going to be a factor next season. Because there aren't draft picks coming. There's nothing
toy,
else.
Toy transfers.
Right? Yeah. There's transfer players that we don't know about yet that maybe we'll be excited about. But if we really feel like Marcus Ahonis can actually...
I mean, by the way, the Huskies do have a pretty big-time recruit coming in Jackson Grant. Like, he's top 40 nationally. Obviously, it's not who we were hoping... He's not all we were hoping for out of this year's class with, you know, Shane Noel locally and Paolo Banchero, but... He is a legit recruit.
Where did Shane Noel go?
Arizona.
How did we not get him?
That's a great question.
Okay. Well,
I was looking at some future recruiting on ESPN.com, and the only player listed as like considering for 2022, I assume just because it's early, is a guy from Rochester. Which we got a chance. We got a chance. If he's from upstate New York. The listener can't see the look you're giving, but they know what it is. They
have a good idea. That look just won Pelton Cast MVP.
Oh, no.
Okay, it beat me out at least. The most important thing is about having hope, though. And so that's exciting to hear about Sahonis. I can approach, look, the fact that you're telling me this and that you as a person who, as far as I can tell, everything I've heard seems to understand basketball, is telling me that
I don't know if you've seen my Twitter mentions.
We should actually be excited about Marcus Sahonis as a player. That gives a glimmer of hope going forward. We can watch this basketball team and not just have to view it from the prism of it's hilarious how bad they are. We can view it through the prism of at least Marcus Sahonis is building something, because that's all that we can take away from the season right now, right? There's nothing else. And if we can feel like anybody is building anything here, I think that is a big, big deal.
Yeah, I would agree.
Also, doesn't Duke suck now?
Duke, yeah, they're pretty middling.
Fucking choice, Paulo. Have fun. Duke sucks now. Coach K is washed.
I think they'll be just fine next year.
You're not a grad transfer, so you don't matter at all in college basketball anymore.
Well,
when you grad transfer back to UW, then you'll matter, Paulo.
We would welcome him. The carpet is laid out for Paolo to transfer to UW. I'm just going to make that clear.
Is Duke going to miss the NCAA tournament?
Probably.
Whoa! Wow.
I don't think they're projected to make it at this point.
Have fun going to the worst culture school in the entire fucking country, and they're not even good at basketball. Nice choice. I hope 1998 calls and tells you that it was a good time to be at Duke.
How recently did they win the national championship?
Maybe the ghost of Grant Hill will walk through the door.
The Okafor year was at the very least. If they haven't won it since then, they definitely won it with Okafor.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how Bobby Hurley is.
Oh, boy.
I know a thing or two about Duke. Jan applauds the choice, though.
She really does. Yes, 2015 was the last time that Duke won the national championship.
It's the 20s now.
You know, I was looking at the 1998 tournament the other day, because I think that's when Stanford made it the year after Brevin Knight graduated. Mm-hmm. They made the Final Four, I should say, not just the tournament. Uh-huh. That wouldn't be that notable.
Tell me more. Why are we talking about this?
I don't. You mentioned 1998. I was going to talk
that
about
that. That was, as far as I recall, that was probably the most that I've ever cared about college basketball. That was, or like the first year that I cared about college basketball. ESPN, the magazine, was out. Miles Simon was hot.
Yes. Andre Miller led Utah to the Final Four that year. I think they lost in the championship game to Kentucky.
1998 college basketball was fun. College basketball is fucking terrible now, but I haven't seen any of it, so I can't really confirm that, but maybe you can for me.
Actually, it's not been a bad year for college basketball from what I've seen, but I'm not watching it every night, certainly.
Speaking of not bad years for college basketball, though.
Well, no, we still have to talk about the upcoming weekend.
We don't.
It's the last scheduled home games for the Huskies, so it could be their senior day as well, although UW versus Arizona State may still be rescheduled. Neither of those teams are scheduled as yet to play on the season's final weekend. Huskies hosting Stanford on Thursday and Cal on Saturday. KenPom considers the Cal game a toss-up, giving the Huskies a chance to potentially avoid the Pac-12 sailor. They're currently a half game ahead of the Bears at 3-13. in conference play.
Are they? That's they're still going to do a Pac-12 tournament? Yes.
Have not committed to that yet.
Okay.
I mean, the idea of bringing all these teams during a pandemic may not be the greatest idea, as it turns out. So, no decision is yet on that one. All right, now let's talk about a not bad year for college basketball, 2003-04. This weekend in 2004, the Huskies hosted the Oregon schools, getting an 83-74 win over the Ducks on Thursday that was highlighted by a Nate Robinson tip dunk over Jordan Kent, son of then Oregon coach Ernie Kent, and now, of course, the play-by-play broadcaster for our Blazers.
It's pretty wild.
We have complex Jordan Kent.
Jordan Kent's pretty solid.
We have complex Jordan Kent feelings. Yucks legend Jordan Kent.
Oh my God. Our feelings about the state of Oregon are pretty complex. It's like the thinking about the Oregon football, I'm like, nope. The Portland Timbers, hate them. And then I see that the Blazers are wearing the like Oregon jerseys. The kind of like Miami Heat style Oregon jerseys. I'm like, those are pretty dope. And I'm like, you know, Oregon's a pretty awesome state.
I mean, they really are, no. Yeah, I mean.
It's complicated. That's our relationship with Oregon. It's complicated.
Facebook status reference. It's the second pod I've heard this week that has referenced Facebook statuses, relationship status. Despite 2004 lottery pick Luke Jackson, this Ducks team was down after losing Luke Ridenour to the Sonics.
There we go.
They were starting freshman Aaron Brooks from Franklin High School at point guard and ended up playing in the NIT where they reached the semifinals before losing to Michigan. I don't remember this because, of course, there was a Sonics game the same night as this at home. But apparently Oregon players were upset after Nate Robinson dunked at the buzzer. And that was a source of some consternation. On Saturday of this weekend, back in 2004, the Huskies narrowly escaped retribution from the Beavers in an 80-79 win. Nate Robinson gave the Huskies for the lead for good with a 3-point play with 1:22 left. Neither team scored over the final 82 seconds, and Chris Stevens missed a possible game winner in the closing seconds. The Huskies won despite a new career high from David Lucas, the son of the Blazers legend and one-time Sonics player Maurice Lucas, who had 29 points.
Who we love slash maybe hate. same as Luke Ridenour. and Aaron Brooks also. I don't know if you recall these specific games in particular, but I feel like this must have been such an exciting time period to have just the switch being flipped and all of a sudden the Huskies being favorites in these games, where we were used to basically a generation of Husky basketball where that wasn't the case. And then
I would say a generation, because there was the Donald Watts, Todd McCullough years in there.
I'm calling post that a generation, those like 5 years. Or whatever.
That's a pretty short generation, but sure.
Like, generations are moving fast these days.
Oh, no.
There was a lot.
Are baby fantasy genius and baby your fantasy genius the same generation?
Totally different. They're Gen AA and Gen BB.
I mean, one of them got into Minecraft way younger than the other.
Oh, God. Don't fucking talk to me about Minecraft.
Actually, baby's fantasy genius got into that younger than either, right?
Anyway, I just... Do you remember the specific weekend of games?
Not particularly. Oh, I mean, as we've talked about,
such a good idea for a segment.
We're just remembering the existence of the games. We don't have to have specific memories of watching, which we will in future games. There will be other games coming that we have specific memories of watching. There will be other games coming that we don't. I, as we mentioned earlier, the Nate Robinson dunk over Jordan Kent, they put it in, I want to say SI for Kids of all places. And I had that on my cubicle wall for several years with the Sonics. So it certainly was a formative moment for me. Well, since we didn't do 2.5 hours worth of the usual podcast this week, we decided the time was right for a special segment with Baby Fantasy Genius.
All right, well, thought it would make sense after the end of the NFL season for us to bring on a special guest. No, this is not the famous Cousin Katie. I don't know if he's ever been a participant or a contender for Peltoncast MVP, which, get your ballots ready right here. we would like to welcome for his second ever appearance on the Peltoncast. You heard him first talking about college sports nicknames. Now he is back to talk about NFL stadium names, a real passion of his, corporate sponsorship. We welcome Baby Fantasy Genius.
Hello.
I mean, it's a passion of ours as well. Shouts again to Pagliacci. But yeah, this came up the other day. This is so, for the longtime listener who remembers, Baby Fantasy Genius used to know all sorts of college sports nicknames, and we quizzed him about it on the podcast and impressed everyone. He's now lost all of that information, but yeah, has replaced it helpfully with stadium names. So we're going to go through some NFL stadiums and their history. Let's start with the New England Patriots. Let's start fairly easily.
All right. So the New England Patriots currently play at Gillette Stadium. In 2001, the AFC divisional game, the Tuck Rule game, was the last game played at Foxborough Stadium. And before that, I don't even...
They played at Harvard Stadium for a year, as well as Fenway Park, an interesting history. But yes, Foxborough, their longtime home, before they moved into Gillette Stadium. How about the Baltimore Ravens?
Ravens currently play at M&T Bank Stadium, I think. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, edit that out.
He takes after his father asking to edit stuff out already.
He also takes after his father and that it will not get edited out.
All right. Yeah, they play at M&T Bank Stadium, and they're relatively new, and I don't think they moved stadiums yet.
Atlanta Falcons.
Falcons play at Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and they used to play...
You don't have to give the full history. You could just say
it's
the stadium.
It's okay to just do the current one.
I want to try to do it with the teams I know.
Okay, let's get into some trickier ones now.
Yeah.
Some that have like been constantly changing. So I'm not sure I know their names, their corporate sponsor names at any given time. Denver Broncos.
The Broncos in Power Field at Mile High. This one's gone through a lot of names.
It sure has.
It's been a lot of names, and the old stadium was Mile High Stadium, and then before that, they played some small stadiums.
It was previously Invesco Field at Mile High, Sports Authority Field at Mile High, both of those. All right, Jacksonville Jaguars.
Jaguars. TIAA Bank Field, and that's the only place they played.
Although I think that's a relatively recent name, TIAA Bank Field, for that.
It is a relatively recent name, I think. I don't know exactly, but...
It was previously Alltel Stadium and Everbank Field. So it's gone through a few incarnations.
Yeah.
Let's do the Houston Texans.
This stadium is the only stadium they've played in. It's gone through two names, Reliant Stadium, then NRG Stadium.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely the case. Arizona Cardinals.
Arizona Cardinals played State Farm Stadium. They used to play at Sundayville Stadium when they moved to Arizona. Before that, they played at Bush Memorial Stadium, then Bush Stadium from 1960 to 65 in St. Louis. And I don't know where they played before that.
Yeah, that's far enough back to go, I would say. How about the Philadelphia Eagles?
They currently play at Lincoln Financial Field, and they used to play at Veterans Stadium.
Correct. The Cleveland Browns.
First Energy Stadium or Field. I can't remember if it's a stadium or a field.
First Energy Stadium, indeed, yes.
Yeah, First Energy Stadium, and... they used to play. I keep getting this mixed up. So I don't know.
That's okay. Buffalo Bills.
This one's gone through a few different names. Currently, Bills Stadium used to be Ralph Wilson Stadium, New Era Field, and yeah, currently it's just Bills Stadium.
Yeah, which is very recent that they. They lost the New Era name and went with Bills Stadium. Miami Dolphins.
Okay, this is a hard one because their stadium's gone through 11 different name changes. but it's currently Hard Rock Stadium.
Okay. Do you know any of the other names?
Yeah. Dolphin Stadium.
Okay, yes, that is.
They won a Super Bowl at what, Joe Robbie Stadium, I think it was.
Yeah. Pro Player Park and Pro Player Stadium for a period of time. And Landshark Stadium and Sun Life Stadium, among the other names that the current Hard Rock Stadium has gone through. How about the side of this year's Super Bowl, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers?
They played at two stadiums. Their current stadium is Raymond James Stadium, and they used to play at some stadium that I can't remember.
Tampa Stadium.
Yeah, Tampa Stadium. Someone with a generic name.
Right. Back before corporate sponsorship was so prevalent.
That was in like 1999, I think.
Through 97. Tennessee Titans.
Titans. Currently, Nissan Stadium used to be a few different names.
It definitely has gone through several names. Nissan Stadium, pretty new name. Previously, Adelphia Coliseum, just the Coliseum, and LP Field.
That's the only one I remember, LP Field.
And can you tell us a little bit of the history of the Tennessee Titans franchise?
They originally were the Oilers in the AFL in 1960. And then they moved to Tennessee in 1997 or 6 and became the Tennessee Oilers. In 99, they changed to the Tennessee Titans, and they've been like that for now.
All right, let's do the Indianapolis Colts.
Indianapolis Colts started off in Baltimore, which I do not know any stadiums they played there. But now they currently play at Lucas Oil Stadium. That's all I know.
Yep, that's correct. How about the Minnesota Vikings?
Minnesota Vikings. They played at a lot of banks.
Yes.
Currently play at U.S. Bank. They played at the University of Minnesota's TCF Bank. And then that stadium that collapsed on the roof was some other bank, I think.
The Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome. That was not corporately sponsored. How about the Carolina Panthers?
Panthers.
Ooh, you want to hit on this one?
Yes, this is going to be the only one I cannot remember.
It's another bank.
It's another bank.
It truly is another bank.
I don't know.
Bank of America Stadium.
Oh, Bank of America.
Bank of America.
I kept thinking Chase Stadium or something.
Being headquartered in Charlotte. Let's see. Are there any other interesting or difficult ones that we haven't gotten here? Well, it had not occurred to me is we do the New Orleans Saints.
The Superdome.
What's the Mercedes-Benz Superdome?
I know.
It had not occurred to me that they were Mercedes-Benz was sponsoring two teams in the NFC South.
Yes, they are. They're sponsoring the Saints. And the other team.
The Falcons.
And the Falcons, yes.
Oh, yes, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
All right, we'll do some easier ones now. San Francisco 49ers.
They play at Levi Stadium. Used to play at Candlestick. Then before that, they played at Kezar Stadium.
Indeed.
Everybody remembers Kezar Stadium. Where do the San Francisco 49ers play? What city?
Santa Clara.
That is correct. I can vouch. I've been out there. On two occasions, as a matter of fact. All right, the new home of the Rams and Chargers.
SoFi Stadium.
Where did the Chargers previously play in L.A.?
Dignity Health Sports Park. Before that, the StubHub Center.
Yep. Yeah, that all checks out. Las Vegas Raiders.
Allegiant Stadium. They used to play at the Oakland Coliseum, then the L.A. Coliseum, then the Anaheim Coliseum, then the Oakland Coliseum. A lot of Coliseums.
There were many Coliseums back in the day.
But
Washington football team.
They currently play at FedEx Field. Used to play at RFK Memorial Stadium.
Giants and Jets.
MetLife.
And where is MetLife located? Do you know that?
East Rutherford, New Jersey.
Pittsburgh Steelers.
They currently play at, is it Heinz Field or Heinz Stadium?
Heinz Field, yes.
Okay. And they used to play at Three River Stadium, I think.
Yep. Dallas Cowboys.
The Dallas Cowboys play at phone company.
It is a phone company, yes. AT&T Stadium.
Yeah, AT&T Stadium. And then they used to play at Texas Stadium.
And when was the last time that the Cowboys made a Super Bowl?
1990 something.
Oh, yeah. I thought you had that off the top of your head.
I did not, but it was in the 90s.
I think those are all the corporately sponsored stadiums, other than, of course, Lumen Field.
Do you want to tell us the history? We can finish here. Thank you for joining us, Luca. Do you want to tell us the history of what is now Lumen Field? I think it's too simple, but the name changes that stadium has gone through.
Definitely.
And the history of where the Seahawks have played.
Oh, definitely.
Right. So the Seahawks, it was changed to Lumen Field for the Vikings game this season. But before that, it was called CenturyLink. And then before that, it was called Quest Field. And then before that, they played at the Kingdom.
Oh, but it was originally Seahawks Stadium. And then you also got a note in between that they played 2 years at Husky Stadium while the Kingdom was being demolished and they were building what is now Lumen Field. So that's the complicated history of the Seahawks. Well, Baby Fantasy Genius, we thank you so much for joining us and look forward to whatever your next area of me-like expertise and memorization is going to be so that you can come back on the pod and share it with us.
I'm excited. I don't care what it's about. I want to be on another podcast. I like this.
I mean, you are going to be our hockey correspondent. You know.
Stop doing these if you don't like them.
Luca doesn't get the joke.
No, he doesn't. You're going to be our hockey correspondent next year when we're going to have a lot of hockey to talk with the Kraken's arrival.
The Kraken's.
Are you keeping up on the NHL season?
And climate pledge already.
Yes. Are you keeping up on
the history also of the current climate pledge arena? What has that been?
Key Arena.
Before that?
And before then?
Key Arena.
Seattle Center Coliseum. And the real heads know. Originally, I believe it was the Century 21 Pavilion.
A lot of centuries in Seattle.
Hopefully a lot of centuries in all of the places.
Okay. Luca, thank you for joining. Can you tell everybody out there how old you are, by the way?
I'm 8.
Thank you for joining us. What year were you born?
2012.
Okay. Before he ever even saw Quest Field, I believe, right?
No, I've never seen Quest Field.
Undoubtedly the case. Oh, I'm sorry. It was the Washington State Pavilion, not the Century 21 Pavilion. Also the Washington State Coliseum, among the name changes that what is now Climate Pledge Arena has gone to. So there you go. The more you know.
Uh-huh.
All right. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for listening.
Here, say thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, everybody that actually is listening. He told me I was going to be in front of like 10 people.
Bye. I said that. I said this is just a conversation between you and Al.
It's just, going away.
That's how all of our guests leave the podcast. Okay. Give me my penguin. I'm going away.